DiscerningHearts.com presents A Church of Passion and Hope, Conversations with Sister Gilles Goulding. Sister Gilles is a member of the Congregation of Jesus and is an associate professor of systematic theology and spirituality at Regis College in the University of Toronto. Alongside her work as a theologian, she undertakes a ministry of spiritual direction and retreat work. In 2012, she was appointed by Pope Benedict XVI as a theological expert to the Synod on the New Evangelization. She is the author of several books and numerous articles that deal with the theology of Hans Urs von Balthasar, the theology of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and Ignatian spirituality. Our series is based on her book, A Church of Passion and Hope. We now begin our conversation with Sister Gilles Goulding. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Sister Gilles, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm very happy to be present with you.
Share with us Mary Ward. Who was she? Who is she today?
Well, she's on the path to sainthood. She's recognized as venerable. She's actually a woman of the 16th, bridging into the 17th century. She was born in 1585 in Yorkshire, so in the north of England, on the 23rd of January. And it's said of that county in one of her biographies that it's that restless, untamed county facing Scotland. So there's a certain sense of a feisty nature to the people from that part of the world. She was born at a time when the Catholic Church was under severe persecution. The Protestant Reformation had taken place, and with Henry VIII, the dissolution of monasteries, and there was a sense within the country of a certain insecurity at the political level, so Catholics were considered suspect. And this is why you had a whole series of what were called penal laws against Catholics, which meant that they were fined for not going to the Church of England. They were imprisoned if they couldn't pay the fines. They were imprisoned or some more serious action taken against them if there was any sense of assisting priests. And gradually, over the period up to the end of the century, there were increasing penalties for being Catholic, practicing the faith in any way, and not attending the Protestant church. So Mary Ward grew up as a young woman in this situation, where her faith meant a great deal to her because she knew the cost of it. Her grandmother was imprisoned for a total of 14 years. One of her earliest memories is of waking during the night, she was living with her grandmother at the time, and seeing her grandmother on her knees at her prie-dieu, praying. She had a difficult family life in the sense of her father particularly had to keep moving around and sending the children to different places, because by dint of these laws, it meant that if a landowner could be found, and he was a small landowner, they were a family of the gentry, so not nobility, but certainly of a certain status in life that could be of certain affluence in life. But if they couldn't, as it were, find him, then he didn't have to pay the fines. So there was something about actually finding the body, a bit like habeas corpus. So in that kind of uncertain situation, Mary Ward came from childhood through to adolescence. It's said of her that her very first word was Jesus. And it was uttered because her mother, thinking that she was going to fall, the baby was going to fall, said, "Jesus, protect my child." And the child turned round and said, "Jesus." And interestingly enough, her very last word as she died was Jesus. And often as she wrote her letters, she would sign them at the end, "Jesus say, Amen," the different things that she had raised with the sisters in different parts of the world. So she came to adolescence and had a real sense of a calling to religious life. Now, in the houses that she lived in during her childhood, there would be houses where a Catholic landowner would gather around them, Catholic servants, and there would be houses of hospitality for priests, There was a secret network of priests. Sounds a little like during the war, I suppose, when they had these sorts of resistance houses and safe houses. Well, it was that kind of practice during the 16th, 17th century. So Mary Ward grew up in houses where there was a great deal of discipline. Mass, when priests were there, was celebrated every day. The sacraments were welcomed and really embraced. And also to the different hours, the divine office, a number of the hours would be prayed together as a household. And the children were always well instructed in the faith. Certainly, the Jesuits then as now provide good educations in the faith. So it was in this kind of climate that Mary Ward came to an understanding of her vocation. And then there were some years where she was not in opposition to her parents, but her parents felt that she could do more good to the Catholic cause in the north by marrying well. And so a variety of suitors came, but each one of them, Mary Ward felt that she could not marry. The last one was the Earl of Westmoreland, so clearly a noble with significant influence. But here again, she felt that she could not agree to this. And actually, the Earl said that if she wouldn't marry him, he wouldn't marry anyone. He later joined the Jesuits and died on the English mission. So then we find eventually her father confessor, a Jesuit, Father Holtby, and her parents came to see that her resolve was set and that this was something of the Lord. So they agreed that she should go to the continent because, of course, there were no longer any religious houses in England. So she left her own land, her family, and all that she had known to move to a different country, to enter the most austere order of the time, the Poor Clares, and really to live a hidden life, a contemplative life. Now, when she got to Saint-Omer, which is where she was headed for, she was, by a particular disposition of Providence, she ended up as an out-sister in a rather overcrowded Poor Clare convent. But there were so many women coming from England that eventually she was instrumental in setting up a convent for English women, a Poor Clare convent, near to Saint-Omer at a place called Gravelines. And here she found what she had been looking for. The convent was set up, everything was in place. She was living the life that she felt that she'd been called to. But God had other plans. On the feast of Saint Athanasius, she had a certain illumination of heart and mind that she was not to be a Poor Clare, that something else, that was something good, the Lord wanted from her. Now this came as a difficult thing for her. She had a very natural contemplative spirit, and yet she was sure that this came from the Lord. So she left the Poor Clare convent. It continued to survive across the centuries, but she herself went back to England, waiting on what would the Lord say that she should be doing.
Did she at this time, sister, have a confessor or even a spiritual director who she could share this discernment with?
She was, through the Jesuits, she was linked with another spiritual director, yes. As she was searching her way, her spiritual director actually said to her, well, what do you think about taking the rule of the Carmelites? But somehow or other, that didn't seem right either. So she continued to pray, well, at that time, doing what we could call the spiritual and corporal works of mercy. Namely, she would be visiting the prisons. That's where you found a lot of Catholics at that time, because of the fines and because of those who couldn't pay them and being imprisoned and such. So she visited the prisons. She prepared the people to meet with the priests. That was quite dangerous work at the time. And she also helped young women by finding dowries for them to go across to enter religious life on the continent. And one day she was just sitting after her time of prayer in the morning. She was sitting brushing her hair in front of a mirror. So just the kind of thing that any woman would do at the beginning of her day. And lo and behold, she had this sudden, again, illumination of mind and heart about the word glory. And it says in the account that she stayed for a period of about 2 to 3 hours, just hearing the echo of this word glory. And she understood that whatever this good thing that she was to do, that she'd heard about on that feast of St. Athanasius, this good thing was something more to the glory of God than it would be her entering Carmelite's life. So we see here another stage in her discernment. First of all, she knows she's not to be a poor Claire, something else, some good thing that the Lord wants of her. Now we hear that that good thing is more to the glory of God. And in that too, we find an echo of the Jesuit understanding of ad maiorem Dei gloriam, to the greater glory of God. So she continued to pray on this while maintaining what she was doing in England. Then one time, following this illumination, she found that she was attracting more and more women who wanted to join her in this search for whatever it was that they were to be doing. And one time she was on the continent, actually visiting a Marian shrine, but she fell ill a day before, so she was resting before going on, and she had this other illumination. This was in 1611. And this one was, take the same of the society. Now she understood that as meaning that she should take the constitutions of the Society of Jesus. She had already herself been formed in the spiritual exercises through her confessors and spiritual directors. And the young women who gathered around her, she also had formed in the exercises. So now she saw clearly she was being asked, called by the Lord, to form a congregation for women that was grounded in spiritual exercises and the constitutions of the Society of Jesus that would be an active women's order. Now at this time, there were no active women's order. Every women's order was enclosed. So this was somewhat revolutionary. And she says of the outcome of this, my confessor resisted, the society opposed, and all seemed to be against. So that's pretty comprehensive of opposition. Mm-hmm. But she was so convinced, and that she wrote later, a couple of years later, to the papal nuncio, when she was describing this vision, this illumination, she said, these were the words whose worth cannot be valued, nor the good they contain too dearly bought. These gave sight where there was none, made known what God would have done, and if ever I be worthy to do anything about this institute, to this place I must come to draw. So there's a clear sense there that she thought this was a foundational illumination. This was what they must do, take the same. This was what the words that were too dearly bought. This is what she had prayed and fasted and taken up practices for mortification for. This was the answer. So the good that was to come out of this was something that could not be too dearly bought. And she was conscious that she must come back to this illumination time and time again as she worked on what it was, how she would actually structure this new body. So that was, again, very significant. Now, finally, in terms of a major illumination, there was one in 1615 that we call the Just Soul Illumination. And here she had a sense of the kind of of specificity of this Ignatian way with regard to our congregation. And she saw it particularly summed up in a certain threefold freedom. And that was a freedom from everything that could make us cling to things of the world. A freedom for all such good works as might be done, so that whole active apostolate, in a similar way to the Jesuits, whatever the needs of the church might be, and education for girls being a clear one, and a freedom to refer all things to God. So she saw that threefold freedom as very integral to the life of members of our congregation. And she spoke often of this freedom to refer all to God, that there was no part of our lives that was not, should not be open in that freedom to the Lord and his leading. Because for her always, the phrase, the will of God, was something so powerful that it drew her heart and mind and always her obedience. And she saw that these illuminations were part of that will of God within the church for women in religious life.
You spoke of her contemplation, and even at a certain point where in the closure of the Poor Clares, there was a peace in her heart. And in that contemplation, this awareness came up. This is what she's being called to do. And really, it is a great model of that contemplative who is in action then.
Yes.
Someone,
yes.
Not to say that those in the enclosure are not contributing or doing anything to that extent, but this was a different type of action, very much in the world that she was being called to, wasn't it?
Yes, that's very helpful. I'm glad you raised that, because certainly she was called to that contemplation in action. And it's clear as she writes of it that that peace that had been hers in the Poor Clares was the keynote of these illuminations also. And we see it as a keynote of the rest of her life. In all the activity, there is a sense, a clear sense, that she has seen the will of what the will of God in her behalf is, and that she is just called to enact that insofar as she is able, in obedience to church authorities, but continuing to raise this up because she sees this is what the Lord is calling for. And we see that apparent very much as her life continues to unfold. She began schools because the education of girls was a paramount need. And whenever she had a fee-paying school, she had a poor school. And the fees from the fee-paying school paid for the poor school. So these were how she managed to educate across the board. And local princes and dignitaries across Europe asked us for our sisters to be setting up schools. So she set up schools in many parts of Europe, and also too in Rome. And in 1621, although documents and such like had gone to Rome from her and from the princes who were supporting her, she felt it was time to go herself to Rome. There were also too those in opposition to this new order, and particularly, unfortunately, in England, there was a very much a contentious situation between the secular clergy and the Jesuits on the English mission. The secular clergy felt that the Jesuits had too much freedom, and there was, one might say, a certain hostility that arose. That being the case, this new group, we were called Jesuitesses because the women were moving around. They were engaged in these different spiritual and corporal works of mercy. They were recognized as following a kind of a line of Ignatian spirituality. And so it was thought that this was a way to beat the Jesuits by calling us Jesuitesses. And of course, congregation wasn't yet approved. On the Jesuit side, they were concerned about any kind of possible association, and not least because they were endeavouring to have canonization of St. Ignatius and St. Francis Xavier. So we fell in the middle of all this. Well, in 1621, as I was saying, Mary Ward decided to go to Rome, and she walked there across Europe. A Europe that was not peaceful, a Europe that was in quite a period of quite different parts in a war situation. But she arrived safely Christmas Eve and went immediately to one of the churches to pray in gratitude for being present. And she stayed in Rome for some time. Each time she visited Rome, and this was not her first walk across Europe to Rome and back, the popes received her with real affection and appreciation. It was said of her that no one could deny the holiness of her person, even though they found it difficult to accept what she was putting forward. And the popes, two popes, Pope Urban and Pope Gregory, Pope Urban VIII and Pope Gregory the 16th, set up a commission of cardinals to investigate this new phenomenon. And eventually they voted against such, or advised against that such a congregation being formed because of the difficulties. It was vastly unusual at the time. Women were considered, it was considered suspicious for women to be outside enclosure. The Pope was particularly concerned about the 30 Years' War and trying to bring some kind of a resolution there, and felt that if some supported and some didn't support this new congregation, that could introduce a divisive factor amongst the princes and so on and so forth. So we find then that there's a closure of some of the schools from about 1625. Mary Ward is not informed about what is going on in terms of the deliberations that have been arrived at by the cardinals. So still, as it were, is sending through information about the structure, the constitutions, these sorts of things. However, in 1631, she's imprisoned in the Anger Convent following the publication of a papal bull which seemed to wipe out the congregation, to anathematize it, to say that the sisters were setting themselves up independently of authority. The language is very strong. So one can imagine the hurt in terms of Mary Ward and the sisters.
I think if we could just gently remind listeners, too, that this particular time in European history, as you've already indicated, is a volatile one as far as what's going on with the princes, the kings, the queens, England, the relationship between Spain, and also what's going on in the New World, trying to determine in that early 1600s. There's so much going on that the political does come into play, unfortunately, sometimes in the church's response.
Absolutely. And in a sense, I think it's always important to raise up the fact that it's hard for us to realize today, but this, as it were, seemed to come out of the blue. The Holy Father was being asked to deal with this extraordinary phenomenon at a time when the whole of Europe particularly is in a volatile situation. There is ongoing suspicion of by England of what Spain might do, of that movement of possible an alliance against England. There's within what we now call Germany, which of course didn't exist until 1870, but all these different little principalities. Some were Protestant, some were Catholic. How would their citizens manage who were of different persuasion? All these sorts of things that were going on. There was vast areas of the New World that were being opened up by voyages of exploration. And in the midst of this, the Pope is trying to set priorities. So clearly anything that might seem to lead towards possible division would be suspect.
This is the time, if I'm not mistaken, right around Robert Bellarmine, Galileo, sciences are opening up mm-hmm. in a way in which the church is trying to discern how do we respond. And even religious communities for sisters, this is before familiar congregations that we might be aware of, say Jean de Chantal and the establishment of those French orders that serve the poor. This is not happening yet.
No. We would be talking about really around the time post-French Revolution. So we're about at least a century and a half prior to this. So in a sense, it gives you a feel for the prophetic vision of Mary Ward. One thing, though, that I think is so powerful is that her calm confidence that the will of God would be done in the future, and that sense that it did not matter that it had to be in her lifetime. But she, as it were, seemed to see across the generations. She said once, women in time to come will do great things. And as we look around in our 21st century, women have done great things, and not least contributed through saints, through holy women, through women who wouldn't consider themselves holy, but just, as it were, continued to live and serve within the church. Those are the women who have done great things and continue to do great things. One of the striking features of Mary Ward, too, was her whole attitude to those who opposed her. In 1625, she had another illuminative insight about forgiveness. And so deep was this that she began to call her enemies her friends. And indeed, her friends said that she prayed so much more for her enemies than for her real friends. But she had this real sense that those who oppose, even those who opposed one, would be part and parcel of the Lord's will unfolding. And I think that's why she had what we could call long-term vision. She was also very at the forefront of a real understanding, I think, of the feminine genius that our more recent popes have brought to the fore for us. She once was heard somebody say, as regards their small communities, oh, well, yes, they do well at the moment, but after all, they are but women. So after a while, their fervor will fade. And she brought this point to her community and said, what do you think the man meant by saying, we are but women? And then she expounded on that and she said, is there such a difference between men and women that women might not also do well and maintain their fervor? And she went on to say, what is most important is not the truth of men, nor the truth of women, but the truth of God. And in that, men and women share equally in that reality. And I think that actually gives a real depth of understanding of what St. Paul talks about, that in Christ, you know, there is neither male nor female. That sense of it's the truth of God, the truth within Christ, that is to lead us forward.
She, from what you've shared with us, seems to have that incredible grace of humility, but also that of obedience. And listening to the voice of the Father, to the will of the Father, and following that out, but also respecting and following that authority in which he established in the church. So she could trust that even when it seemed to be going against what she knew she was being called to.
That's very true, and I thank you for raising it at this point. It's a very clear sense running through her life and her writings. When she was in prison, she wrote to the sisters saying that they must cooperate totally with the church authorities. As she was in prison, she was actually quite ill. She was not least, perhaps, because she had been put into a small cell of one of the religious. The previous occupant had died from a contagious disease. Luckily, she didn't catch that, but her health was quite fragile through her life. And it was thought at one point that she might be going to die. So she was told that if she wrote a retraction saying that, you know, she had been disobedient and she now repented of that, then she would be able to receive the final sacraments. And what she wrote was, "I have ever and always desired to be a faithful daughter of the church." And the man in charge, the priest in charge, was so convinced of the truth of that, that he gave her the last sacraments, and actually then she recovered. It was very clear that she saw it was most important that the sisters should be loyal, devoted daughters of the church. And that somehow, and this is very much an Ignatian principle, that the Spirit guides and governs through authority and through the individual. And that interaction ultimately brings the will of God. So she was putting into practice a very core idea, central to the constitutions and to the Ignatian way of proceeding. I think you're right, she was very, very humble. And it wasn't in saying that she was a faithful daughter that she was trying to be pretentious, but she was articulating what she understood, a little like the way Saint Thérèse articulated what she understood. And it's very striking that when she was released but from prison after only a month in the prison, the order came to her, and it was around Holy Week, and she said she would like to stay. The order, I think, was brought on the Friday, and she said she would like to stay till after Palm Sunday to begin Holy Week there. It seemed to her appropriate. And then she went back to England later on and to York, and this was the time of the Civil War. And she actually died in the last year of the Civil War in a small village, as it was then, outside York. And it said of the where she was buried in the churchyard, we know the churchyard she was buried in, it was said that the Protestant minister was honest enough to be bribed that she could be buried there. We don't have her grave. We don't know which is her grave. We do have her gravestone, on which it says, "To love the poor and persevere in the same was all the aim of Mary Ward." And to love the poor was fundamental to anything that she was involved in. The care of the poor was a priority for her and her sisters throughout their lives. So it wasn't just that they educated the poor girls, but they would always reach out to the poor from their communities wherever they were placed. That to love the poor and persevere in the same was the same of the Society of Jesus. So even on her tombstone, that illumination that was so fundamental, part of it is written there. So that she would continue in that way of the same of the Society.
You've been listening to A Church of Passion and Hope, Conversations with Sister Jill Goulding. To learn more about the book of the same name, authored by Sister Jill, go to bloomsbury.com, the website for its publisher, Bloomsbury, T&T Clark. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, visit discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for A Church of Passion and Hope, Conversations with Sister Jill Goulding.